Good evening. This is Deirdre Flowers interviewing Dr. Sandy Poitier-Johnson on the evening of November 25th, 2013 in her home located at 273 West 132nd Street. Good evening, Dr. Johnson. I'd like to thank you first for agreeing to assist me with my class project, and I'd like to open up and talk about your life here in Harlem, your education experience, and your educational leadership experience, having been the principal at Thurgood Marshall. So the first question that I'd like to ask is, can you tell me a bit about your upbringing or your growing up here in Harlem?
Well, I've always lived in Harlem, and I'm an only child. And grew up on 132nd Street, where I currently still live, and was very poor. My parents never finished school. My father never finished elementary school, and I think my mother maybe went to middle school but didn't finish school after that. And they always had a vision of providing for me what they could not, what they were not provided with when they were growing up. So I remember my father really took a business that most people would think would not make much money. He shined shoes. And one day, he used to shine shoes up in Washington Heights in a barbershop. And my father was a very, everyone liked my father. They always said, Charlie is a great guy.
Do you remember the exact location of that shop?
No, I just know it was Washington Heights. So to me, it was in this, what is it, a very Latino area now. I don't know what it was then. Mm-hmm. It could have been much, I think I'm quite sure it was much different. Probably was a much more Jewish area or white area. And yeah, it had to be white, because when this man met my father and he really liked him, he said, Charlie, I want you to come and work for me in my building. So my father came home and told us he was leaving, told my mother, he said, that he was leaving this steady job at the barbershop to go work in this building. I said, what kind of building? It's the story they tell me. Well, apparently this man was the CEO of Philip Morris, which was big time then. And his building was 100 Park Avenue on 41st Street. And they did not have anyone there to shine shoes. So he gave that whole building to my father, did never charge him any fee for any vendorship in that building. And my father actually had appointments made for him to come and shine people's shoes. And it became a very lucrative business for him, which helped put me through college, gave me my first job, provided him with tons of suits from people who didn't want to wear their suits anymore. Just really, if I told people his job, they would never think it would lead to the lucrative end that it did. My mother was a factory worker. She was a draper. And a draper is a person who puts the finishing touches on a garment. So the pleats, the buttons, any finishing piece. And together, they gave me whatever they needed to, as a very poor family, almost to give me all the opportunities so that they know that I would be successful. So what does that mean? Well, I went to private school. To School on the Hill, which is not in existence anymore. It's a Lutheran school. And it's on 100, and it was on 141st, 145th, on the corner of Convent Avenue. It was a school and then a Lutheran church. It's right across the street from Convent Avenue Baptist Church. And I went there from kindergarten through sixth grade. And then they couldn't afford it any longer. So they researched. I don't know, my mother, even though they didn't have paper schooling, they were very smart as to garnishing resources or knowing what, how to get for me what they wanted for me to achieve. So they researched it, and the bus driver The guy who drove the school bus that picked me up for the private school, it was called School on the Hill, lived in the Bronx near the Westchester line. And so my mother were friends with them, so she negotiated to use his address and send me outside of Harlem to Upper Bronx near Westchester to school.
What year was that?
I graduated 65, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. I want to say either 1959 or 1960.
Did your parents give a reason why they didn't want you to go to school in Harlem?
Well, the schools in this area were not deemed the best schools back then. We're talking about decades ago. And some of the schools were not safe, gang-related. I know that IS 136, when I was growing up, a student was murdered in the building. Somebody drowned her in the toilet. So my parents were not going to send me to any school in District 5. And historically, many parents in District 5 did not send their children to probably more middle schools in District 5, because there were a lot of students at the school I went to that lived right in Harlem. We used to travel together all the time.
So IS 136 would have been your zoned school?
Yes. That's the school on 135th and Edgecombe Avenue, and it was an all-girls school. And you could look up the history of it. I don't know much about the history of the school, but it was notorious, and it was eventually closed. I don't know if that incident led to the closing of it, but my parents were definitely not going to send me to a place where they didn't feel I would be safe, particularly because I think I lived a very sheltered life. I went to school in the morning. My parents always had me in after school programs because they worked. When the bus came home, I dropped off at 6 o'clock, did homework, went to bed. I had dancing lessons, I had piano lessons. So they always had activities for me. So I wasn't a kid who you would see playing on the street.
Did you have friends in the neighborhood?
Only friends I had were friends I went to school with. I really didn't have friends in the block. I mean, I knew people, they saw me, I saw them. If I go to the store, you know, we kind of see each other all the time and we would say, hi, I know your name, you know mine. But it wasn't a relationship where we went to each other's house because we didn't go to the same schools. Our parents didn't go to the same church. You know, my mother was very active in Abyssinian Baptist Church, you know, and I used to say, don't I get a break? I was in school like 7 days a week, you know. There was some regular school Monday through Friday. Saturday was some kind of school, whether it was dancing school, piano lessons. She even sent me, I guess I was in high school at that time, she sent me to a lot, and a lot of young ladies went there during the 60s, was Ophelia DeVore Charm School. It was just thought of that every young lady had to go to charm school before going to college so that they would know the proper etiquette. I hated it, but, you know.
And this was in conjunction with high school, so you went to the charm school as you were in high school.
Yeah, but it wasn't part of high school.
It wasn't part of high school.
No, it was something you did on the weekend.
Okay.
That my parents had to pay for. And it was housed in the old Ed Sullivan, where Ed Sullivan had his TV show downtown. I think it's in the early 50s or late 40s on Broadway, there is a theater. It used to be called the Ed Sullivan Theater, where his show was filmed. And it was an office building adjacent to it or on top of it. And that's where Ophelia DeVore is really known. She was a model, very famous, very popular in the 60s, and felt that what she learned as a model needed to be transferred to young ladies coming up. So it was very popular to be in her school. You know, we had different classes on etiquette, walking, talking, conversation, clothes. My mother, I guess I did it when I was in 11th grade or 12th grade, because my mother used that as a way to know what to buy me to go to college, because she had never gone. None of her relatives had ever gone. None of my father's family had ever gone. I was probably the first person between their two families that went to college.
So you went straight through, all the way through, attaining a doctorate. First generation college.
Yeah, well, I didn't go.
Not saying straight through, but mm-hmm. when you say that your parents, neither of them had college degrees, and possibly no one else in their family had them, you were the first generation.
At that time.
And you went through to a terminal degree.
Right. It doesn't mean nobody in my family has a degree now.
Oh, no.
It means that I was, like, the first. Not that I think of it. I never thought of it in that way. But, yeah.
I think of it that way, too, because yeah. neither of my parents had a college degree, and mm-hmm. I'm first generation, and if I ever finish this PhD, I'll be like you, and an only child as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's a question. You mentioned IS 136 would have been your school. Are you familiar at all with the case of the Harlem Nine?
You're not talking about recently. You're talking about...
Back in the mid to late 50s, there were a group of parents who boycotted three junior high schools. And in the paperwork that I've seen, they've been called junior high schools instead of IS or
mm-hmm.
PS.
Right.
136, 139, and 120.
No, I never heard of them. What are they?
So these parents, working in conjunction with Kenneth Clark and his folks at the Northside Center, if I'm calling it correctly.
Yeah, on 110th Street.
On 110th Street. Mm-hmm. I think that was their last location.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there were two more in different places in Harlem. I think they started out at Dunbar Apartments, and I think they moved further north before they moved down to 110th Street. They declared that these schools, the children in Central Harlem weren't allowed to go out of their district, and I can't remember if it was like District 12 or 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But based on the curriculum and the overcrowding and the fact that the schools were majority one race, and in this case mostly black and Hispanic, and the fact that the children couldn't compete when they got out of these junior high schools and when they went to high school, or they were failing to go to college, the parents boycotted the schools, saying that they were offering a inferior education and that they were segregated.
Mm-hmm.
And there was... there were several cases in the courts, and there was a case that ended up in, I'm going to say, the children's court. Justine Wise Pollyer was the justice who found in support of the parents, saying that the schools were inferior and that something needed to be done, but it didn't have like a legal binding, and a legal binding, or set a legal precedent, but it wasn't binding on the Board of Ed.
Mm.
And the Board of Ed, through from the mid-50s straight up, probably until the 70s, and even maybe now, parents are still discussing or in some way saying that the education may not be meeting their needs. So for this class, I was writing on that particular topic
mm-hmm.
when I came into this class, and that's one of the reasons I took the class. But as I'm thinking about Harlem and the work that you've done in the schools with the Board of Ed, wondering how you got from attending a private school to, where did you go for high school?
I went to Olinville Junior High School on Barnes Avenue in the Bronx, and then Evander Childs, which was a top high school at that time.
In the Bronx as well.
Which was about maybe 85% white.
Hmm.
And only 15% black or Hispanic.
So how is it that your early education affected your, I guess, career trajectory? How did you decide What about your early education made you decide that education was a course you wanted to pursue?
Well, it really wasn't a course I wanted to pursue. I really wanted to be a psychiatrist, but I said it took too long. Who would stay in school all those years to become a doctor? In hindsight, I did go to school all those years, but at that age, I was not in my mind to ever spend that many years in school. So what I did was I majored in psychology. And then for my master's, I focused on working with the emotionally handicapped. Because I felt as a psychiatrist, you know, you help people with emotional disorders. I thought that would put me closer to the field that I wanted to be in. But as I got into that field, working with the emotionally handicapped, I found that most of them were learning disabled, that a lot of them had educational issues and wanted to learn more about that because I don't think you could treat one without the other. And so that's what kind of led me to, and I really don't know, I was very young. I applied for my doctorate at Columbia like when I was like 22 or 23. I was very young.
So right out of undergrad?
No. How did I do that? I'm just trying to think. I think what I did was, I can't remember. I'm quite sure when I graduated from Morgan, I can't remember. I can't remember whether I went straight to Columbia and then decided to go to Bank Street. I can't remember the order because I'm a senior now. But I do know that the reason I went to Columbia is because I felt there was compound issues with kids who were troubled. And I got accepted in the doctoral program in my early 20s. And I went a year and I was blown away. I was like not ready for Columbia's environment. I'm coming from an historically black school and going into a school where most of the students did not look like me. I think I was the only person of color in my department. Mm-hmm. I felt whereas in historically black school, I don't want to say our hands were held, but people knew your name. You know, if you didn't show up to class, you'd get a call from the, you know, it was more of a nurturing family environment. And that's what I was used to. But at Columbia, you had to grow up very quickly. You were on your own. You had to figure it out.
It was grad school.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to figure it out. And not that the advisors didn't help you or work with you, but you had to determine what the work was, what the focus was. A lot of work you had to do that I wasn't used to. And it completely blew me away. And so I went for 1 year and dropped out for 9. Because you have 10 years until you lose your admission status. Mm-hmm. So I went back in my mid-30s. And because I didn't want to lose, kind of was older, more mature, mm-hmm. more experienced, more looking professionally down the line, what I wanted to do. And so that's when I got accepted into the Learning Disabilities Department at Columbia. And it's very interesting because I was the only teacher of color in the school that I was working in at the time that I applied originally to Columbia. And the other teachers in the school had also applied to the doctoral program.
Is that Montague School?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And when they apparently got their letters before I did, and they didn't get in. And so when we were having lunch, they said, oh, we got our letters. We didn't get in. Well, I guess we'll have to try again. So I said, well, I didn't get my letter yet. She said, oh, you know, we all, you know. But when I got my letter for acceptance, I said, oh, I got accepted. Their first question was, how'd you get accepted? So I think they said that before they really thought about what they said. I didn't answer it because I didn't want to dignify it with a response.
What do you think caused their response?
That I was a person of color and that they were more qualified than me. They were more, they taught longer. I was young. I mean, how could I get in? And they were in their 30s and didn't get in. They had much more experience. But I had more professional training. I went to Bank Street. Yeah, I'm quite sure it was Bank Street. Yeah, I was at Bank Street and then I went to Columbia. Mm-hmm. And why I know that is my advisor was Selma Sapir, which was a well-renowned learning disability specialist internationally. And she wrote my recommendation. Plus, I didn't go to a CUNY school. I went to Bank Street. Bank Street was a very progressive, up-and-coming school, top school on education. If you went to Bank Street and came out, you were known to have a well-rounded training as a teacher or a practitioner. So they went to City Colleges. Now, I'm not saying City Colleges weren't great, but I know the training. I taught as a professor at City College, and I went as a student to Bank Street. There's a big difference. There's a big difference in the
at
people.
At the graduate level.
Yes. There's a big difference. A big difference in the students that go there, the training that you're given. I mean, we had access to the experts. You know, people, Elsbeth Pfeiffer was head of the one department, and she was the one who started the Children's Psychiatric Center at Bellevue, you know. So I was surrounded by the experts, you know, and I don't know if that level of training happened at the other colleges, the public colleges or CUNY, whatever.
So to take a step back for a minute, can you tell me about your time at Morgan? I think you mentioned already that your major was psychology. Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you did when you were on campus? What were some of the extracurricular activities?
Oh, you really don't want to know that, do you?
Yes.
Because it wasn't it wasn't educational.
Ah, social?
My first year, I had a tough time transitioning. First of all, I didn't want to go to Morgan. I cried for a month. I thought if I called my parents and cried every day and ran up their telephone bill, they would say, oh, we have to have our baby come home, but it didn't work. And I guess after a month, I realized I wasn't going anywhere, so I just kind of figured it out. And there were a lot of students there from New York, so we kind of bonded. Really made some good friends that I'm still friends with. My best friend, Geneva, I met, you know, at college. I think that Morgan, if I could say what were the best years of my life besides, you know, our children and my husband, it was Morgan. It really changed me. I was at the end of high school. I kind of think my middle school hormones didn't come out until 11th grade, 12th grade, and I just like was full blown. I was always very studious, but I turned the opposite in my 11th and 12th year. I did a lot of truanting. I gave liquor parties. I mean, I could go on and tell you I was just horrible. I mean, I was just absolutely, I can't tell you. I don't know what happened to me. I fell in love with this young man who I thought was just the god. And, you know, and he was, of course, not in school. Mm-hmm. And John was about a year or two older than me. And so that's the only thing. I would leave in the morning with my bag and I just double back home knowing my parents had left and come home and just do, it was just horrible. Now, what happened was, you know, the communities at that time were very stable. And so there were people in the neighborhood who I considered aunts and uncles, you know, who really weren't, But because they were our neighbors, and out of respect, you always say, aunt this, aunt that. Well, they threw me under the bus. You know, they would see me come home. So they told my parents eventually, and I got caught and went on lockdown. And I barely got out of high school. I think the only reason I got into more, I don't even know, I think my parents filled out the application. I mean, I didn't have any part of the process because the schools were not very helpful at that time.
Mm-hmm. The high schools?
Yeah. I remember the guidance counselor at my school telling my mother that she thinks I should go to cosmetology school. My mother knew that that was not what she had in mind for me. And so she said, thank you very much. And she, you know, again, rallied with other parents who were sending, because everyone went to college. There was no way nobody would go to college when I was growing up. That's what in this neighborhood, everybody applied to college that I knew. Everybody applied. I mean, that was the goal. So she talked with other parents, I guess, and I guess I didn't fill out the application because I was rebellious at that point, you know. And I guess I did good on my SATs because I didn't have any remedial courses mm-hmm. because they did have an A, B, and C track. The A track was remedial, so you could only take like 10 credits, 10 or 11 credits. Plus remedial courses.
That's in college?
In college.
Okay.
And I was on a B track, which means I could take up to 16 with no remediation. And C meant you were gifted, I guess, and you could take up to 18 to 20 credits, you know, which meant you would graduate earlier. And so I was really angry with them that they sent me there. I didn't want to go there, you know. Baltimore, Maryland. My parents didn't drive, they didn't have a car, but they packed my trunk, mailed it, I guess, and got on a bus with them, Greyhound or Trailways, and I mean, they made it happen for me. I had my little fur stole, because that's what Ophelia DeVore said, you had to have a little fur stole, and I had my little they did what they had to do. I didn't understand it then, and maybe I wasn't supposed to, you know, just do it. And I was miserable the first month, but then I kind of knew I wasn't coming home. And so I had to make it work. I made friends, and it was the best years of my life, the best, my best friendships, my best times. It just made me a person. It really formulated who I am today. I doubt if I would be where I am today if I had not gone to Morgan. Being surrounded by role models that look like me, most of the professors were people of color, really took an interest in you. A lot of young people that I came from all different places that I've never been with such high aspirations. You know, once you surround yourself, you are who you surround yourself with. And I wasn't surrounding myself with the right people. Most of the people I hung out with are dead or either in jail. None of them went to college. None of them survived. So I was really hanging.
These are people from high school?
These are people from the neighborhood.
Okay. Okay.
And that I really, in that 11th and 12th year, friends of my boyfriend, you know, mm-hmm. stuff. And it was the best 4 years. I graduated with honors. I got the exemplary award from the psychology department. Although my first year, they kicked me off campus because I didn't have a strong enough average to stay on. They kicked me out of school, but I couldn't stay on campus. And again, but was lucky, my parents, you know, did their resources, and the college had housing off campus, and I got it with three other young ladies who we became very good friends right down the road. And maybe it was better because I could be more focused studying in the house rather than in the dorm where so much was going on. And it worked out. And I graduated on time. Never had to go to summer school. And did very well.
So you were at Morgan in the 60s.
I was a cheerleader. I became a cheerleader. I was a freshman class officer. Or was it sophomore? It was one of the years, freshman or sophomore. I pledged AKA. Matter of fact, the day we went online was the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated, April 4th, 1968. You know, so a lot of memories, a lot of people we still keep in touch. It was just really a wonderful, wonderful time in my life that I will never forget.
Now, while you were on campus in the midst of the Civil Rights Movement,
I was in Baltimore. I mean, I was on campus for a year. That was from 64.
Well, when I say on campus, I really mean just in college.
Oh, okay.
Just simply in college.
Right.
What were the students like at Morgan? Did they participate in any of the Civil Rights Movement activities? I know that in 1960, the four students from North Carolina A&T are credited with kind of reinvigorating the Civil Rights Movement by staging that, what some people call the first, but what is really not the first, sit-in. There were several, there are many going back many, many years, sit-ins that were staged. But did the students at Morgan, were they active?
Yeah, we were. I wasn't, because my mother told me, look, girl, I sent you down there. People in the North were not, how can I say, the kids, students from the North were not as socially conscious, I should say. Not because we weren't, didn't want to be, we just didn't have the experience. A lot of our friends, they had the experience of only drinking at a fountain for colored people, or sitting in certain seats because they were colored.
Restarting the discussion with Dr. Johnson, you were talking about experience of students from the North versus students from the South.
You know, I could sit anywhere I wanted on the bus. I never had that experience. I could go in any store. It doesn't mean maybe I was treated differently, but it wasn't that I couldn't buy in the store. I think more up north, people didn't work in it. They didn't hire people of color, but it doesn't mean that people of color couldn't go into the stores. Where in the South, a lot of my friends had a more different type of experience. You know, Ku Klux Klan. I used to see it on TV, but it was not up in my backyard, you know, like some of my friends had, or the lynchings, or all of that stuff. You know, my friends from Birmingham, Alabama, you know, I don't know if the three young ladies were bombed. I forget what.
Four young ladies, and I want to say that was 1963.
Yeah, so, you know, they had all those personal upfront. And ours were more detached. It was more things we read about and didn't experience. And so my mother and father were not told me, you know, I was not allowed to protest. That was it. They put their money in. They want me kicked out of school. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure I get that degree. You know, you can protest after, but you ain't going to protest now. So I never was part of the protest. However, there were many protests of students at Morgan State College, some making the college more aware of the need for them to become more active in the civil rights movement. We had a shopping center right up the hill from the school. It was called North something, North Side, North Manor. I can't remember the exact name. But they had a beauty salon in there, and students used to try to go to get their hair done, and they would not do students of color's hair. They only do white people's hair. And so that got the students to protest to shut down the whole shopping center. Like, we protested by no one would go up to the restaurant, to the movie theater, to the clothing store, whatever was up there, we would not shop. And that's the major protest that I remember. I mean, we've had a Ku Klux Klan burned a cross on our campus. It was very frightening, but the most frightening time was April 4th, 1968, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. He was on lockdown. I mean, you could see smoke. I could literally see the smoke from D.C., the fires that were burning. We wanted to go home, but we couldn't get off campus. We didn't have transportation. We couldn't get downtown to the bus station. It was just, it was a real horrible time. I mean, I had a hard time getting home. And I'd never seen that. I've never seen riots before or burnings like that.
So were you coming home because of a particular time, or you just wanted to go home?
Oh, no. They shut the school down. We needed to go home. We were trying to get home.
So when you finally did get home, what was Harlem like?
More riots. I left riots to come home to riots. I was inside, but I remember how my mother and the other neighbors went out to the dry cleaners because their clothes was in there, and they were getting ready to rob and burn. And they drew a human body link in front, because they said, "No, that's our clothes. Why are you, why are you hurting us? It's not us you're really angry at."
Do you know who the owner of the cleaners was?
It was a person of color. Most of the businesses when I grew up in Harlem were business of color, because white folks didn't have businesses up here, major businesses. I mean, we had the fish and chip place, we had the grocery stores, we had the cleaners, and we had the beauty parlors. So there was you could truly say that in Harlem, the service was provided by people of color. I can't say that now. The grocery stores are Middle Eastern. The beauty parlors are Dominican. Or the braiding stores are African. The cleaners are Asian. Even the business my father started, Shoeshine, are not people of color anymore. We do not have any service industry or business that we can say we are the major service providers of. No more.
What do you think has caused that shift? And where are we if we're not in the service industry anymore?
We're the consumers. We are the people who spend our money to get those services. We don't provide them. Our businesses, if we do start, don't last a lot. You know, they open and they close. They're not long-lasting. Why does that happen? There's many reasons why. Economics. I think the downfall of our community, for me, started with the Vietnam War. I think a lot of
And
our,
that's the 50s?
No, it's in the 60s.
In the 60s? Okay.
And I think after the war ended, I can't remember what year it was, a lot of our young men came home drug addicted or so traumatized by the ravages of war that they were not socially, available. To come home, to start families, to work. And then the infusion of crack in our communities, which led to a flight of many people from Harlem, where there was just a huge number of empty, abandoned buildings or crack houses. There was that flight to suburbia, Queens, Jamaica, oh my God. That was the flight. That was like the better life. And Harlem was no longer in its golden age, It was not the place to live. If you say, "Oh, I'm going to Harlem." Oh, Harlem? You know, when we bought our brownstone, we bought our brownstone for $4,000 in the 80s. And we tried to get some of our friends to buy. Oh, no, we ain't moving to Holland. You kidding? All that crack houses. There are no services. There were no stores. I couldn't even get a tape to rent. There were no, like, Blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
The tapes were being rented in bodegas and grocery stores. And in order to rent a tape, I would say, well, do you want my credit card? Oh, no, we just need to see your phone bill or electric bill. I mean, you couldn't use a credit card anywhere in Harlem. Nobody would deliver. Everything was cash and carry. There were no services. You always had to go outside of the community for a great grocery store, great restaurant, movie theater. You know, Magic Johnson is new. For many years, we didn't have a movie theater in Harlem. It was just, you were redlined. We were redlined in this neighborhood. But I always had, I don't know if my husband had as much a vision as I, because he's just been great. He's always supported any vision I've had, even though he didn't understand where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
I literally, this house was owned by the barber that did my father's hair.
Mm.
And when my husband started talking about moving to Queens, I knew that it would either mean divorce or I'd have to find something in Harlem. And so I came back to my old neighborhood. My parents had passed at that point. As a matter of fact, it was the same year that my parents passed. Shortly after my parents passed, 6 months to the day. It was a very traumatic time for me. In November, I lost my father. In February, I lost my second child. I had a miscarriage. I had to deliver, which was. And then my mother passed in May. So it was a really rough time for me. And that's when I started becoming very involved in the church. Anyway, I had been up here volunteering with the church, and my husband said he was moving to Queens. I said, oh, no, baby. Sandy ain't going to Queens. So I came back to my block. And
where were you living at the time? You were in Harlem, but where were you before you bought this brownstone?
96th Street in Amsterdam Avenue. And I came back to this block, and I don't know, the brownstones weren't in. They were not in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I just think it's a divine destiny. You know, why I was looking at these buildings. I never grew up in a brownstone. I didn't know what a brownstone looked like inside. I grew up in a tenement house. But I knew I didn't want to go to Queens. I was not going to Queens. And the barber, what was his name? I can't remember his name. I asked him about, you know, any houses for sale on the block. All I knew was a house.
Mm-hmm.
My husband wanted a house. This was considered a house.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, Mr. Gaddy, who owned the candy store on the corner, where we used to get our candy as a child all the time. He said, you know, Mr. Gaddy has a house, and I don't think he wants it. So I said, okay, I'll go and ask him. So I did. And he said, true, I'm walking away from it. He said, I'm not paying any taxes. The city can have it back. I says, well, Mr. Gaddy, I really would like that house. I said, I'm going to buy it. I didn't even look inside it. He just showed me where it was. I went and saw the front of the house. I went back to the corner. I said, Mr. Gaddy, I want this house. I'm going to buy it. Can you tell me how much? He said, $1,750. That's the first thing he said. So I said, okay, Mr. Gaddy. I said, I'm going to give you a deposit right now to lock us in. So Tommy had given me a check to go pay Con Edison, but I didn't fill it out yet. So I filled it out, made it to him for $100, because he's from old school. The old school businessmen, black businessmen, it's only about your honor and your word. and a handshake, and it was good. I knew that. So I gave him the check, and then I called Tommy and told him what I did and hung up the phone so he could just breathe and understand what I did. And then, because Tommy's handy, and so he said, okay, let's do this. So he came and he saw the inside of the house. You can see pictures on the wall there of how it looked. And he said, okay, let's get this house. So I went back, and Mr. Gag said, okay, we have to find a lawyer. He said, oh, I don't want a lawyer, you just can have that. No, we gotta have a lawyer, Mr. Gaddy. So his lawyer was our lawyer. We paid for his lawyer. And he raised the price that his wife thought it was not enough, so that's where it got to $4,000. And at that time, even though $4,000 doesn't sound like a lot, my parents had just passed. I had spent a lot of money on medical mm-hmm. bills. Really wasn't saving money at that time. I was a spender, loved shopping, never thought of buying a house. It was something very quick that I had done. But we managed. Let me pay it off a little bit at a time. And we got this house. It took us a year to do the demolition. We did our own demolition. Every Saturday we would come up. And it took us a year to get it to at least a point where we had a space, just part of the house where we could live. We had a kitchen that consisted of a hot stove, a hot plate.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my mother's friends gave us a refrigerator. And that was about it. We lived very raw here. It took a while. It took about 7 or 8 years for at least to get some type of a kitchen. And to do, it took us 8 years to do all this work. 8, 9 years to do. 5 years to strip all the wood. It was a task. It was a task. But you have to have the vision. That my favorite Bible verse is, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not yet seen. So being involved in the church at that time, and I just believe that it would be such a great thing. It would be a much bigger thing that we could not see. What was the original question?
I think we started out with you just telling me about yourself. You raised a lot of interesting points in terms of talking about the housing and the purchase of the house. And it's making me think to your work at Abyssinian, with the Abyssinian Development Corporation. Also, you touched on, when you were talking about your schooling, you talked about going to after school programs, and I know that you started youth programs when I think in the 80s, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk a little bit about what inspired you to start the youth programs in the community? What inspired you to, become more involved with the church and become involved with their development corporation? And eventually, I want to move on to talk about your work at Thurgood Marshall as well.
I think that we as a people, when we get to a certain professional level, particularly in the North, we tend to move out of the communities that we grew up in and move to other communities that, quote unquote, give us better service or give us sort of a status quo. And Harlem became what it became in the 70s because a lot of us baby boomers who came out of college in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of us didn't return to our neighborhoods. Because we were elevated professionally and economically, mm-hmm. as our parents wanted us to be. So we went to the high-risers downtown or bought the condos or mm-hmm. went out to suburbia, whatever. We didn't come back to our communities. And I always remember our friends who graduated and lived down south. They couldn't do that. because of the segregation laws. So they were relegated to go back to their communities. But by going back and using their skills and experience, their communities were uplifted because there was a very diverse community of occupations and people. Whereas in Harlem, it became kind of lopsided because we all moved out. Those of us who could afford it, we moved other places. We didn't come back and invest in our community. We didn't give back what our community gave to us. If it was not for Reverend Adam Clayton Powell developing legislation that developed the poverty programs of the 60s, HARU Act, which was the poverty, that's what taught me to type. That's what got me off the streets. And I lost my thought there. Those opportunities disappeared in the late 70s or mid 70s for young people, just disappeared. And so coming back to Harlem for me was, I wanted to give back what they gave to me. I would not be who I am today if it wasn't for my church, and if it wasn't for my mother and father believing in me, and if it wasn't for a community that helped my parents raise me, which doesn't exist now. I mean, you could have a tenant living next to you for 2 months, and before you know it, someone else is in there. And that apartment has been rented 6 or 7 times in a year. That didn't happen. You didn't see that when I was growing up. Aunt Sally was in that apartment for 30 years, 25 years. I mean, people just didn't come and go. People were always there until they died or something, but not like this revolving door. It was not a revolving door, a community, you know? So I felt that I always had some type of social consciousness. It just didn't come to my awareness until I was like in my 20s. I don't know what brought it to my awareness. I mean, my mother was always taking care of everybody else's children and stuff, you know. So I knew we always had to share and give back. But I really wanted to give back to the community in some way. And so my awareness kind of started after my mother's funeral. My father died first, then my mother. And you know, it's a tradition in the Baptist church, I don't know if your church does it, but we leave flowers on the pulpit that Sunday after the funeral. And so it was my thought that I was going to go and drop those flowers off, and I didn't want to go back to the church at all.
And your father and mother were members of Abyssinia?
No, my father was not. My father never went to church. He only went if I was performing. Or
was his funeral at Abyssinian?
Nope, neither was my mother's. And that's because I didn't really know the connection. I had not been involved in the church. Remember, I went away to college in 65, and my parents died in the 80s. So I had no connection with the church or anything. I was so glad to get away from the church because as a child, I didn't really embrace the church and wanted to go. I went because I had to go. And so it was a sense of control. I ain't going to try and getting up early in the morning. I don't want to hear someone yelling, I didn't want to hear it. So I did not get involved back in the church until my parents got sick. And my mother wanted to go to church and she needed me to take her. And that's how I started going back to church. And then when she passed, I took those flowers, like a good Baptist child, but I was going to get the hell out of Dodge. And I was standing somewhere, I can't remember, like in the hallway that doesn't exist now because we've remodeled the church. And Reverend Butts called my name. And I'm saying, well, I didn't turn around at first because I hadn't been here in like 10 or 15 years. And someone, they must be talking to some other Sandra. Because they said Sandra. And I knew no one who really knows me called me Sandra. It's Sandy.
Is that your name?
Sandra is my official name.
I never knew that.
It's on my birth certificate. My mother called. My mother and father named me. And so I heard this name. So I finally turned around and he said, could you come here? So I said, oh, yeah, thank you for doing my parents' funeral. I did, you know. He said, so what do you do? I said, I'm a teacher. He says, well, you know, I'm trying to do this after school program at the church. Would you be interested in helping me? Now, why he asked me, I do not know. So I said, oh, God. I said, I'm a good Baptist child, so I can't say no to a minister. So what I thought is, I said, okay, I'll say yes. I'll go to one meeting, but that would be it. Wouldn't see me no more, at least I tried. Well, that didn't happen. I went to the meeting, listened to what people said. There was a really great group of people at this meeting, and so I really felt comfortable. And I said, oh, this is not so bad. So not only did I volunteer for the after school program, I coordinated it. And that was the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. And I coordinated that for several years. And then one day, Reverend Butts called me at the job and said, Sandra, I'd like you to be on this committee. I don't know if we use the word committee or board. I thought he was talking about a church club.
Oh.
So I said, oh, okay. So I went to the meeting. And it was the founding board members for Abyssinian Development Corporation. With no church club. This was really bigger. I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
What year was that?
1987. So I said, wow. I said, this is an organization that really wants to make an impact on Harlem and really raise the quality of life for people. I said, that sounds really good. So, okay. I'm going to do this. And I've been involved with Abyssinia. We were incorporated in 1989. So we were celebrating their 25th anniversary next year. And it's a wonderful organization. It was developed initially out of the need for affordable housing for not just affordable, but affordable and quality housing for residents of Harlem. And what spurred the development of that was that one day Reverend Butts walked up and down 138th Street. And 138th Street was blighted. It was a lot of abandoned houses, empty lots. You would see crack needles all over the street. It was horrible. Here there was this prestigious, socially active church of Adam Clayton Powell Jr. sitting in the midst of this garbage, not doing anything about it.
How long had he been at the church when he decided to create Abyssinian Development
Corporation? How long had who been?
A Reverend Butts.
Reverend Butts came to the church in about 1971 or 72 as an intern from Union Theological Seminary. And he's been there for almost 40 years. And he came under the tutelage of Reverend Dr. Samuel D. Proctor. And so Reverend Proctor was still there as the executive, as the head pastor, mm-hmm. when this, when this revelation came about. as far as that we needed to get involved in the, more in the community. And so he gathered, I would say about 15 or 17 church members, all coming from different walks of life, lawyers, teachers, just going around the table, professors, civil service workers, and he selected us, and we started Abyssinian Development Corporation. Prior to Abyssinian being started, they had developed another board called the Abyssinian Housing Development Fund. And that board was the one that oversaw our first housing project, which is the senior citizens housing on 131st between Lenox and 5th. And what was unique about that senior citizen housing residence is that it provided on-site services for senior citizens, recreational, social, medical, so to speak, that there's a doctor there, but helping people keep their appointments. They had a social worker there. Mm-hmm. And a beautiful building, right, on 131st between Lenox and 5th. And I remember that the block, again, was infested with crack houses, and we organized the Tenants Association of the block to try to, you know, change the environment, which we did. We worked with the police department. It was kind of dangerous at one point because the drug dealers used to come into our meetings to see who was there, and it would intimidate some of the, I mean, we didn't live on the block, but the tenants who came to the meetings did, and kind of intimidating. But we persisted and prevailed and really turned that block around and developed some condominiums directly across the street from the houses. But anyway, how that senior citizen housing was the first, and then came our shelter for displaced families in Harlem, and then came our Head Start Center, mm-hmm. and then came the schools. But within that time, we had many different projects in Harlem. We did the Pathmark. We also did the H&M, where H&M is. We did that whole strip with the mm-hmm. We call it Harlem Center Project, from H&M all the way to Lenox Avenue and across to 126th Street where Planet Fitness is. Mm-hmm. We did that whole development. We have many pockets of affordable housing throughout Harlem. We've developed almost 1,400 affordable housing units in Harlem, marketed over 100 and sold and renovated over 100 brownstones. Mm-hmm. What else? Also, at one point did economic development, where we actually had a Central Harlem Local Development Corporation as a subsidiary of ADC that actually gave small business loans to businesses who needed to either enhance or develop a more quality environment for their business. Yep.
Now, it sounded like to me a couple of seconds ago that you said schools, mm-hmm. as in plural.
Yeah.
There was more than Thurgood Marshall.
Well, we have more than one Thurgood Marshall program. We have our elementary school, we have our middle school, and we have our high school, and they're seen as three separate entities.
Ah, elementary, middle, and high school.
Mm-hmm. And then we have three Head Start centers. And now we've even reached outside and worked with Bread and Roses, which is a failing high school that we're trying to help. and a school in the Bronx that the Board of Ed gave Abyssinian Development Corporation a contract to provide after-school services.
Can you take a step back and tell me how Thurgood Marshall Academy started?
Well, Thurgood Marshall Academy started in 1993, and in 1992, a proposal came out from New Visions for Public Schools in conjunction with the Board of Ed, a proposal for anyone to develop a public school that could deliver quality educational services that could impact student performance. And this came out of the Annenberg money. Annenberg was a man who left billions and billions of dollars to public education. And New Visions for Public School was the agency that was formed as the fiduciary to distribute those funds. Reverend Butts got the proposal across his desk one Sunday. Someone sent it to him. And he felt that if our community was going to change for the better, that even though we put better housing and have economic development, that it would not persist if we did not have a highly educated community. And looking at the quality of schools at that time, which was not great, and with parents sending their children outside of the community for better schools, he felt that parents in our community should have a choice of good schools where they live. And if they choose to send their children outside of the community, then it should be a choice and not a forced option. Mm. And so he asked for volunteers to write the proposal to start Thurgood Marshall Academy. So myself and about six other church members got together, and we wrote the proposal for Thurgood Marshall Academy. Submitted the application. There was about 300 organizations that had submitted applications, but only 12 applications would be chosen. And we were one of 12 that were chosen to start the first smaller public learning communities in New York City.
How many of those applications do you know were targeted towards Harlem?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. Because it was opened up to the whole city. So it wasn't targeted for a community, any community. Harlem could have had 1,000 applications. It depends upon who wanted to submit an application and go through that application process. But at that time, most of the schools in New York City were in the thousands as far as population. This was the first wave of schools being less than 600. We could not go more than 600 students. And people looked at that and didn't think of us, oh, what kind of school is that? Only 600 kids? Is that a real school? They don't work hard. They don't have the problems that we have with 2,000 students, blah, blah, say, blah, 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 blah. But we were one of the first 12. And I don't know how many of those 12 still exist.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have closed. Did not survive. When we started, it was just seven of us. We had input into the hiring of the principal and staff. You know, we participated in the interviews and everything.
When you say seven of us, who's the seven? Not who specifically, but the committee was a committee of seven?
Seven planning committees.
Okay.
From the church.
Okay.
They were all church members.
Okay.
And they weren't all educators. One was a speech pathologist. Another was the head of the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And then most of us, though, were teachers. And so we submitted the proposal in 92. It was accepted. The school opened up in 93. And whatever could go wrong with the school, for the first 3 years went wrong. Nobody who was on the planning committee worked in the school. We just had, we were able to input our opinions on who should be hired. And so for the first 3 years, there was three principals. It was a new idea as far as this smaller school population and a faith-based institution being involved in education. We were not warmly received in the community. At that time, the structure was, there was a superintendent and then there was community school boards.
Mm.
And neither of them. And I don't know whether it was just faith-based or whether it was Reverend Butts, because he was very vocal at that time. He began to become a voice of political, social activism.
Mm.
But we did not get the support that we would need from a district. To the point as 1 year, they wouldn't even give us enough desks. We had to rent desks in order for our kids to have a place to study. So because they didn't support it and because it was felt they just dumped kids on our school, in the school, not that we didn't want to take challenge kids, but you don't want to have a school with all challenge kids. It has to be a good balance mm-hmm. so that there's a good role model that they can bounce off of each other. And I guess you have to know how to work partnerships. Partnerships are great, but you have to know how to work them and massage them so that the end goal is met. And I don't think the principals at that time, they were good principals,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they knew about how to really utilize the partnerships and resources in Harlem in order to make the school a productive and effective school.
Were they from Harlem?
Supported, and because it was felt they just dumped kids on our school, in the school. Not that we didn't want to take challenge kids, but you don't want to have a school with all challenge kids. It has to be a good balance mm-hmm. so that there's a good role model that they can bounce off of each other. And I guess you have to know how to work partnerships. Partnerships are great, but you have to know how to work them and massage them so that the end goal is met. And I don't think the principals at that time, they were good principals,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they knew about how to really utilize the partnerships and resources in Harlem in order to make the school a productive and effective school.
Were they from Harlem?
One was from Harlem. But all of them had worked in Harlem at one point mm. or another.
Had they all been teachers before mm-hmm. assuming the principalship?
Yes. One was already a principal that switched to become the principal of Thurgood Marshall. One was a teacher who became the principal, and one was an assistant principal who became a principal. So there was all different levels
okay.
of experience. So they were not new, brand new, mature women. They weren't in their 20s, you know. They were in their 30s or 40s. I can't remember, you know. But every year for the first 3 years, the school got worse. You know, whatever could go wrong went wrong. We were treated like stepchildren because we were taking up space of someone else's school building.
How did you guys come to use the space in 136?
Board of Ed.
Board of Ed assigned it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were first in the Choir Academy building. And then we could not expand any more in there. And so the first year we were in the Choir Academy building, and the second year we moved to IS 136.
Okay.
Okay, so the first principal was in Choir Academy. The second principal was at 136, and the third principal was at 136. And two chancellors had come to see the school because Reverend Butts is very highly respected, you know, mm-hmm. and thought of. And so they didn't just come down and shut us down. But they came to see the school, and they said it was the worst school they had ever seen. You know how it still even was existing. I mean, student performance decreased. There was a high rate of behavior incidents that generated the establishment of a scanning station in the school where kids had to go through scanning.
Metal detectors?
Metal detectors,
okay.
Right. It just was, the kids called the school a bootleg school. You know, they were supposed to wear uniforms. They didn't wear uniforms. There was graffiti all over the, I mean, it was just not an environment. The planning committee, for reasons which I will not share with you in this interview, was not involved in the first year. But then became involved again in the second year. And really did some after-school training and tried to, you know, work with teachers. But if you're not there during the day, you know, it doesn't. So anyway, it was supposed to close. We heard through the grapevine that we were going to close it. And Reverend Butts, I can't remember the chancellors. We've been through so many chancellors.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say it was Rudy Crew. It was either Rudy Crew or was it Macchiarola? I can't remember. Anyway, he asked for one more chance, and that's when he asked me to take over the school. And I said, "Are you crazy? I absolutely do not want to be an administrator. I did not. I didn't go to school to become a principal."
So you were still at Montague at that time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's a public school?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a public school. It's for severely emotionally handicapped kids. It's a very unique program. It was a collaboration with Jewish Board of Family and Children Services mm-hmm. and the Board of Ed to provide on-site psychiatric therapeutic services to public school students. So our school was only 30 students. Psychiatrist was on-site. We had 3 psychiatric social workers. Classrooms were no more than 12. It was all year round school because a lot of the kids were on psychotropic medication, so there was a doctor. I mean, it was very well. Our kids really did well if they could stay in the program because it was so nurturing. And I mean, we did everything we could for those kids, you know, to even paying some rent sometime, the agency mm-hmm. stepped in. So I really had an experience of only working in settings like this for 28 years. I never worked in regular ed. I only worked in special ed. So anyway, I said, "Are you kidding? I didn't go to school to become a principal. I don't wanna do it." Now, just to step back, while I was at Columbia, you had to choose an elective. So I saw all the other people taking administration courses. So I said, "Well, I guess I should take the administration courses too." So I did. I took enough to get my license. To become it's called a SAS. They changed the title now, but the SAS qualifies you to become a building principal.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be a superintendent with the SAS. You need a DAS, a district mm-hmm. something, administrative supervisor. So what I did, and I got my credits, but I never filed for the license. I never ever filed to get the license. So when he asked me, and I said, "No, I don't want to do it." But it's really, Deidre, a divine destiny. Because I don't know why I took those administration courses. I had never in my mind thought I would become, I'm not a paper person. I become one, but I would never, I'm more hands-on, student, not being in an office. So I quickly said no. He kept asking.
How many times did he ask?
Oh my God. I can't even remember every time I saw him. I mean, I think he started in like March. And I think I reconsidered in May. I felt that, again, we can complain about the education that's going on in our communities, but we don't do anything about it. And I felt that if it was going to change, then we had to be part of the change. We always let outside people come in and try to fix things for our community. We need to fix it ourselves. And so I said, okay. I talked to Tommy and the kids, our children that were living with us at that time. And because I said, if I do it, you know how I am. It's 100%. It's like, you know, you won't have to take a back burner. I said, go for it. So I told Reverend Lutz, I said, okay, I'm going to try it. I said, and even if I fail, it will not be a failure to me, because a failure is not trying. So they had to rush and get my license submitted. They had to talk to the commissioner and rush it through. Usually takes like about 6 months for filing and paperwork and stuff. I think I got it in an expedited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so June 30th, I was a special education teacher with 30 students, never having any administrative experience. And on July 1st, I was the principal of Thurgood Marshall Academy.
And this was 1996?
Yes. And I did something very interesting. I had knew the teachers because I had volunteered there after school. I didn't get rid of any of the teachers. Because usually there's three things they usually do with failing schools. They get rid of the principal, they get rid of the teachers, and they change the name of the school. I only did one of those three things. And only one of those three things happened. That was leadership change.
Mm-hmm.
I met with the teachers and I said, you know, I've been volunteering with you guys and I know what some of the issues are. I said, so I'm not going to excess anyone. I said, because I don't think you've had the support or the resources you really needed to be effective in the classroom. So we're going to work hard this summer getting all the whatever we need to mm-hmm. make sure the school is going to be one of the top schools. And you have to trust me that I'm going to do my best to make sure that happens. And they kind of believed in me because I used to be able to get certain things for them when I was volunteering if they needed for their classroom, just by asking church members or getting other resources from people mm-hmm. I knew. And so we worked very hard that summer. We looked at the curriculum, got rid of all the graffiti. We had paint teams. We went to 125th Street, bought these plants and mm-hmm. motivational posters. We whitewashed the school, cleaned it up, scrubbed the desk.
How many floors were you on at that time?
Two.
Two, okay.
Put carpet. I put like throw rugs. I had a office. I made sure there was a couch in there and just did everything we could to make it the most pleasant environment that kids could be in an educational setting. Did a lot of outreach during the summer. Told parents, your child had to wear a uniform. And if you had the money, we'd get it for you. I'm not going to give you the money. We're going to buy it for you.
Mm.
And there was no excuse. A white shirt, black pants, black skirt, and a school sweater. That's all we asked. And we worked hard. The teachers believed that it was going to happen. And I remember standing in front of the students that day in the auditorium.
The first day of school?
Mm-hmm. I just told them point blank. I said, you all know you have a bad rep. but I know you are not what the rep is about the school. I know that this could be a great school, but it can't be a great school just because I say it's a great school. You all have to demonstrate that it can be great, that you want to be great, that I know you can be great. And we had all the staff just lined up in the front together, like a unit, like a... Mm-hmm. And we just said what our expectations were, what would not be tolerated. Didn't matter what level you read on, what you're performing, that's where you are now, but this is where you're going to be when you leave us. And I can't tell you, we started to see changes within the same month.
How many students did you have when you started?
About 300.
And when you left, how many students were there?
About 550. We got the scanning of metal detectors removed in 2 years because the behavior incidents went down really mm-hmm. low. The students became more socially responsible. I think it was very significant that I lived in the neighborhood. Because I told them, I said, I know what corner you should be standing on, and I know what corner you should not be standing on. And if I see you on that corner that you're not standing on, I'm going to be in your Kool-Aid. So we made it known that our rules were not just within the walls. Mm-hmm. It was in the community. And I made it a conscious effort to hire teachers that lived in the community so that about 85% of our teachers lived in the community. They were our neighbors. So that we would see our parents in the nail salon. I could have, while I'm getting my hair weaved, we could have a parent conference there, and it'd be on a much different level mm-hmm. because I'm not someone who just comes in the community and then leaves at the end of the day. I understand the dynamics, the social. I hear the gunshots too. I know, the issues that our community has, and because I live here too. I'm your neighbor. And so the level of communication was on a different level. It was, the intimidation was not there. Mm-hmm. Parents share some very intimate pieces of their life with me that they needed help with. Once I helped them, they could be better parents with their children. And so that helped us to really get to improve the student performance at our school. I think my first graduating class, we were like at 90% above grade level, We've always had challenges with our middle school. Middle school is tough.
That's 6, 7, and 8.
Oh, yes. Middle school is real tough because based on the developmental period, and we really needed more resources. Mm-hmm. But what was great about our school is that 90% of our middle school students stay for high school. So if we didn't get it right in middle school, we got it right in high school.
So did the school did not start as a grade school. It started at the middle school level. Yes. And then went to a high school, and yes. Then you added the lower school.
Yes.
Okay.
We first had the Head Start Center, and mm-hmm. then we started the middle school going up to high school, but we realized that getting the kids just in sixth grade was already too late.
Right.
So in 2004, we decided to develop the elementary school. And right now, as I left, the year I retired, 2010 was the first year that we got a cohort of students from the elementary school to
the junior high.
And so this year is the first year they're now in high school. So we're really tracking these students to see what the longitudinal impact of being in a pipeline, receiving the same services from the same organization and the same school has on the performance of the students.
So are are the students from Thurgood Marshall Academy, when they're graduating from high school, are they going on to college?
90% of our kids go on to college. But everybody has a plan, whether it's college or career.
Mm-hmm.
And our persistent rate, meaning those who have passed through at least the first year of college, because that's the highest dropout rate, in our last study was about 83%.
So about 83% of the students that went to college made it through their first year.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing now is another give back is when I retired, I started, because I know all the graduating classes, all of them, and I decided to start an alumni association. Because I don't think they're strong alumni. They're more strong. The stronger alumni associations exist in the South. Urban schools do not have, other than having a dance, they do not have strong alumni association. So my friend told me, who's a lawyer, said that the Legal Defense, the Legal Aid Society has a program called Community Development Project, where they help organizations get their 501c3 not-for-profit status for free. So I gathered some of my alumni, because they were all talking about getting together, mm-hmm. but they were talking about getting together for a party.
Mm-hmm.
So I got them together, about 10 of them, all from different years,
mm-hmm.
and told them about my idea for alumni association. They loved it. It took a while for them to get it that it wasn't Dr. Johnson's organization. It was theirs, and they had to run it, organize the meetings. Took about a year and a half for us to get to that point. But they have really taken it on. I mean, really taken it on. We're to the point that they've actually they have a Facebook page and on Instagram. We've given scholarships the last 2 years that the alumni has donated. And this year we started our first program called Senior Saturdays, where alumni, I mean, I'm there with them and another teacher who is involved, mm-hmm. who's helping me with it. But they're doing a Senior Saturdays, which is a program that helps the current seniors at Thurgood Marshall develop their college essays.
Mm.
So our first part of it is college essays. Right, college essays, then we're going to do scholarships and resumes and then survival skills. And
the survival skills for college?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And or career.
Okay.
And the program goes from November until May. And this is the first year we're doing it.
So you're still active with Thurgood Marshall, even though
absolutely.
You are retired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the work doesn't stop when they graduate from high school. It doesn't stop when they graduate from college. A lot of these students do not have strong family situations. Some come from dysfunctional families. And so our school has become the family. I mean, we have actually taken kids to college because their parents couldn't. We have actually raised money. There was one young lady who was accepted to, get it right, Vassar.
Hmm.
And with the financial aid package was missing a couple of thousand, and we were able to raise the money in order for her to fill that gap so that she could go and figure it out later, you know, and not miss that opportunity. We have done home visits. We've done whatever it takes to make sure that that child has as many options when they graduate from college. We also have a very strong wellness program where we actually have a suite of doctor's offices in our school that's sponsored by Columbia Presbyterian. And we have a nurse practitioner who can give full physical exams, immunizations. We have a strong sex ed program. Very few pregnancies in our school. If they're pregnant, I don't know about it because they've made a decision on what to do with
mm-hmm.
with that state that we are not privy to. I just know that I don't see many pregnant girls in our school at all. I think in the 16 years I was there, I could probably tell you that maybe I know of about maybe 20.
Now, how long has that program been in the school? I was there on Saturday for a meeting all day, and I actually got a quick tour of that medical suite. Mm-hmm. How long has that program been in the school?
Since when I came. It started when I came.
Okay.
In 96. What program were you there on Sabbath?
It was a Delta meeting.
Oh, yeah. No, I know they have the meeting there.
Yeah, we had the
As
Delta meeting
fact,
and we
I
met
started
the principal.
That. They, I forgot who was it when I was there. They used to meet in the library. I don't know if you all still meet in the library. But one our librarian
Munira.
Is a librarian. And so she asked, could the doctor? Sure, it don't matter.
And Gloria Mabry, who's the, she's a physician assistant.
Right, she's a Delta too.
And is there Zena Mingo, is she working there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were all there, and yeah. We were there all day.
And there's another one, they're Delta, Epps.
Thais?
Yes.
Thais, okay,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. So we've talked for quite a bit of time here.
Mm-hmm. Did I meet my 2 hours?
I think we're almost to the 2 hours. What I do want to ask, this is, I guess, kind of like the ending question, and this could go on for hours, I guess. From your youth in Harlem to now, your retirement, living basically on the same block or where you grew up, in the same area where you grew up, what are some of the changes that you've seen across all of that time in Harlem? Good, bad, ugly? How would you sum it up? What do you think of it? And where do you think Harlem as a community is going?
Mm. Well, the changes that I've seen are all relegated to the gentrification process that probably started kind of subtly in the 80s, like the late 80s. No, I almost said 90s. In the 90s. So what changes? More police present in the community when other people were moving into our community. I've seen the infusion of businesses that I used to have to go downtown to shop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're building a Macy's on 125th Street. Whole Foods is coming to Lenox Avenue. We have...
I knew about the Whole Foods, but not the Macy's.
Yes, that's a new thing.
That could be a problem.
Yeah, it's going to be a Macy's. We have a Westin. We've never had a major hotel in Harlem.
Aloft.
We have Westin. Aloft is mm-hmm. part of the Westin.
Mm-hmm.
We now have a major movie theater, which we didn't have for years. We always had to go downtown somewhere. When I grew up...
86th Street.
Yeah, when I grew up, we had the RKO Alhambra right there on 7th Avenue between 125th and 126th, where the bowling alley mm-hmm. is and where that restaurant used to be.
Mm-hmm.
That used to be the RKO Alhambra. They took down the marquee and everything, but it used to be our movie. We had two movie theaters.
I didn't know it was a movie theater.
Mm-hmm. That was the RKO Alhambra, and around the corner... Between 7th and 8th, you'll still see the marquee there. It used to be the Lois Theater.
Okay.
It's where there's a lot of people selling stuff, but you'll mm-hmm. see the marquee. It's in the middle of the block, near the traffic light that's in the middle of the block.
Right, right. Is that the one that is? Was that still the Victoria 105?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But that's the Lois Theater.
Okay.
I've seen the decline of black businesses in Harlem. An infusion of major chains and restaurants that would never have thought of coming to Harlem. But I think 9/11 changed all that. Because on 9/11, there were all kind of people up here in Harlem because it appeared to be the safest place. People were walking through our community dazed, but it was a safe place. And then people really started moving uptown because they left downtown.
Mm-hmm.
No one wanted to live downtown anymore. Harlem was perfect. We're 5 minutes from Jersey. 5 minutes from Queens across the Triborough. Mm-hmm. Still can get downtown near the 1, 2, 3, A, B, near all major transportation. So there started to be an infusion of people from diverse backgrounds. There seemed to be an infusion of businesses that never would ever come up here. I mean, Joe's Crab Shack. I mean, that's a suburbia restaurant.
It certainly is.
Joe's Crab Shack on 8th Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Red Lobster.
On 125th.
On 125th. Those people usually don't even build a restaurant unless there's a parking lot next to it. There's no parking lot next to these because people walk to these restaurants. It's an urban, area. The infusion of charter schools, which that's a whole nother 12-hour interview. I'll just say something to think about is, why does Harlem have the most charter schools per square mile than any other community in the United States? It's a thought. I have seen the decline of respect for public education. That it's inferior. When our mayor has gone to public school.
Mayor-elect or Bloomberg?
Mayor Bloomberg.
Okay.
You know, when many, Barbara Streisand, I think she went to, if I'm not mistaken, LaGuardia. I mean, there's a lot of very successful people that graduated and did well with a public education, and it's just not respected as it was when I was growing up. Affordable housing doesn't exist. Abyssinian Development Corporation, I think, is only one of the major community organizations that is making sure that a lot of our residents are not displaced. And one good example of that is our taking over Innis House on 7th Avenue between 123rd and 124th, mm-hmm. where the landlords walked away from it. Holes in the wall, rats infested, lots of problems. And tenants came to us to help them develop a strong tenants association and to help redevelop the building. You know, we're having a little issues. We were caught in a recession, mm-hmm. and so we're at a stalemate kind of with the new building that we were building on 123rd Street, but we will resolve it.
123rd and what?
Between 7th and 8th.
Okay.
You know, it's half built, and you just have to, but there are many other, there are a lot of construction sites that you see where the construction was
halted,
you know, for many reasons. But clearly that's an example that had we not gotten involved in that, that building might have become an example of gentrification, the building becoming just a high market rental building. And now it's really a Section 8 building. Mm. And so that's a very big difference, you know. It's not a moneymaker for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that we provide housing and so that gentrification doesn't displace our residents. What else do I see? Now, the pros are, yeah, I like that I don't have to go across the bridge or downtown to eat at Red Lobster or Joe's Crab Shack. Yeah, I like the fact that, yeah, Whole Foods is coming because our community likes to eat healthy too. And so now we're getting more healthy alternatives, you know, for us to choose from. Yeah, I like it that I don't have to go to 86th Street anymore, that I can walk from my house to go to the theater. I like all of those things. I like that the block that my house is on, I don't see crack houses anymore. And most of the owners in my block live in their houses. And even though it's diverse, you know, we tend to be a good community on our block. You know, I love my block. I mean, this is a great block to live on. I guess that's what stands out in my mind the most. And each of those is its own separate interview as to why those pros and cons exist. That's about it. I would never live anywhere else but Harlem. I think Harlem to me is a community and a family. Mm. When you walk down the street, there's never, I will never get to my destination without someone saying hello. Someone will always say, they don't know you, but they always will say hello. I lived on 86th Street. Nobody said hello to me. You know, they probably was wondering why I was down there. As a matter of fact, when we were growing up, we, you know, there's always this thing across 110th Street was always better. So it was always my dream to live downtown. And I did live downtown. We had a duplex apartment on 87th Street off Central Park. It was the worst experience of my life. I couldn't wait to get back to Harlem. I came home one day. The super was cleaning my door. I said, why are you cleaning the door? He said, I'm cleaning the blood off because your neighbor's husband tried to knock a bottle over his wife's head, and she tried to get to you to get some help and left blood all over your door. And then one day, duplex, I had a skylight. Mm-hmm. I'm sleeping, and the police broke through my skylight to raid the wrong apartment. They were trying to raid the other apartment that was a drug place. I said, I moved down here to pay all this rent for this crap. And so I went to a Mitchell Lama building on 96th Street for a long time. And then when my husband started talking about Queens, that's what got me back to Harlem. And I love it. I would never live. My husband really wants to move down, so I tell him to go. I would never leave Harlem. There was no place that has the cultural diversity and history that Harlem has of our people. Plus New York, I would never leave. It has mass transportation. Is it perfect? No, but it gets you from point A to B, wherever you want to go, 24 hours a day. And it has the best health institutions. The best everything, you know, and yeah, it's not perfect, but no place is perfect. No. And Harlem, to me, I would never live anywhere else. I love Harlem. I breathe Harlem. I would never leave.
One final question. Would you mind telling me what year you were born?
No. I'm glad to tell you, because there's some people who can't tell you what year they're born because they're dead.
Well, this too is true.
I was born in 1947.
1947. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm going to be 66 in December.
December 11th, I know.
Yes, yes.
It's the day I start my new job.
Yes, congratulations.
Okay, thank you, Ms. J, for helping me out with this. I will be in touch. I'll transcribe all of this and then be in touch with the next steps as we go through the ending of the semester.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.